rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Bratbol, Judge Kalatowski, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding.
Good morning, and you may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm glad everyone made it here safely. No one came from southern Minnesota, maybe from farther south than that.
Right over.
Right. So we're here on the case of Carlson versus BNSF. It's A18-0966. And when you begin your arguments, if you would state your name for the record. Each side will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes rebuttal if you choose to use it. Are you ready?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chris Moreland, and I'm here today on behalf of my client Jason Carlson to respectfully request that this court reverse a district court's order that vitiated a $207,000 loss of earning capacity award rendered in his favor by a jury after a week-long trial. This court reviews the district court's decision to grant BNSF's motion for judgment as a matter of law de novo. The court's function here is a limited one. It's simply to determine whether the record contains any competent evidence that reasonably tends to sustain the verdict. In making that determination, the court must consider the evidence in the light most favorable to my client, Mr. Carlson, and the verdict must be reinstated if it can be sustained on any reasonable theory of the evidence, according to Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. Before we talk about the abundant record evidence that supported the jury's verdict, I want to take a step back and put this into context just a little bit because I think it's important, and it's something that the district court did not specifically acknowledge in considering the future earning capacity issue, and that is that this is a case under the Federal Employers Liability Act. And that is important because the United States Supreme Court has long recognized, and this court has a long history with FELA cases, and I know that there have been a few up here in the recent past, but the point is that the FELA is an avowed departure from the rules of common law, and it's a liberal statute that has to be liberally interpreted in favor of injured railroad employees. The purpose of it was not to equalize the playing field between railroad employees and their employers, but rather to tip the balance in the employee's favor and encourage the recovery of damages for workplace injuries. So in granting the BNSF's motion for a judgment of as a matter of law post-trial, the district court did not cite any FELA cases, did not analyze it in the context of the FELA cases, and thus missed out on some of the legal principles that govern this case, which are that a trial by a jury is, in fact, part and parcel of the FELA remedy, that under the FELA, the jury's power to engage in inferences is broader than it is in typical common law actions, that all the evidence has to be interpreted in favor of the plaintiff, which is, of course, the standard here. And as this court said in Gallagher versus Burlington Northern and Santa Fe, the evidentiary burden on a FELA plaintiff is, quote, significantly lighter than it would be in an ordinary negligence case. And ultimately, this court has held in the Smith versus Suline case that a FELA plaintiff can reach the jury on evidence that is scarcely more substantial than pigeon bone broth. So I think it's just important to note that and put that in the context of what the evidence has to be viewed at this stage. And I think the district court did not pay attention to that and applied common law principles. And even those, I think, as we'll talk about in a little bit, under Minnesota law and Minnesota precedent would have resulted or should have resulted.
That was my question, counsel. Yeah. So, I mean, you're emphasizing your position, which is that federal law governs our analysis of the issue,
correct,
know, future loss of earning capacity. Is there really a material difference between Minnesota state law and the FELA? And I don't mean to suggest that your argument is not well taken, but
sure,
I'm just trying to understand its overall.
Sure. The difference is that simply the benefit of the doubt in FELA cases goes more to the plaintiff than in a common law action. It's just an easier standard for the plaintiff to meet in FELA cases. And so in terms of how it works out here today, I will argue and believe that even if you apply Minnesota state law as elucidated in the Quapian case, the result should be the same, i.e. the reinstatement of the jury's verdict. Another principle to keep in mind at the outset, of course, is that loss of earning capacity is not an item of special damages. It's a an item of general damage, and it permits recovery for loss or diminution of a capacity to earn. And that exists wholly apart from any pecuniary benefit that the exercise of that right may have. So it's not necessary for a plaintiff to demonstrate that he is going to suffer an immediate or even eventual loss of actual earnings to recover for a loss of earning capacity. Under the FILA, all he has to show is that his economic horizons have been limited. His ability to earn going forward has been limited in some way.
Is medical testimony required? I think that's the point that the respondents are making in their brief.
Well, medical testimony.
And again, when I say required, I mean to uphold the jury's verdict.
Sure.
In this instance.
The answer to that is there is not necessarily expert testimony required to support a loss of earning capacity claim. Now, we have expert testimony in this case in the form of testimony from Dr. Karen Pacheco, who was Mr. Carlson's treating physician. She works at the world-renowned National Jewish Medical and Research Center in Denver.
When you say there isn't medical evidence required to prove up a loss of earning capacity claim, again, you know, looking backwards at the sufficiency of the evidence,
correct.
What case law do you rely on for that?
Sure. And those are the cases that are cited in our reply brief. And those would be primarily the Russell case from the Alabama Supreme Court, the Danko versus Union Pacific case from the Northern District of Texas in 2007, Newsom versus Wisconsin Central, Eastern District of Wisconsin, 2015, and also Kwapian versus Starr, Minnesota Court of Appeals, 1987. And maybe that's a good place to start with that.
Well, discussion. I guess what I want to focus sure. on a bit is it's pretty obvious that neither side is relying on Eighth Circuit case law. So I think you're telling me that there is no directly relevant Eighth Circuit case law on this issue.
I'm telling you, A, that that's true. There is no directly relevant Eighth Circuit case law on the issue. And even if there were, FILA is a national statute, so.
And I understand.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So but yes, you're correct. Your point is well taken.
Right.
If there were a great Eighth Circuit case, I certainly would have cited it to you. So what we have in this case is medical testimony that establishes the nature of the injury, the causation of the injury, and the ongoing ramifications and sequelae of the injury. And so what Dr. Pacheco testified to.
And I don't okay. hear the respondents challenging the sufficiency of the evidence, at least on the first two categories,
sure.
the nature of the injury and the causation. That's, of course, for them to argue and clarify if I'm misunderstanding their argument. It seems to me they're going to the third
They are,
so
but I just wanted
to... You'd be specific. I know you've already done this in your brief, but it helps us to sort of drill down to the specifics
of
the testimony you rely on to as medical evidence in support of the loss of future earning capacity.
Right. Okay. And my point in mentioning the first two is only to say that we have those things because expert testimony as to specific jobs that somebody cannot do or specific opportunities that they may have lost under the cases that I just cited to you is not required to support a loss of earning capacity claim in the FILA. Now, I think we have that here because we do have. Now, you know, the BNSF makes a big point of continuously pulling these quotes from the testimony and the record that say, you know, Mr. Carlson was not restricted in his job activities. But I don't think that's accurate. He is very significantly restricted in his activities. He is subject.
You know, to their point, the medical opinion at the time was that he could return to work without restrictions. And obviously that's a very specialized term. And I think you're trying to get more to the larger context of Mr. Carlson's injuries, which is that he had some ongoing limitations, permanent injury into the future.
Correct. Yeah. But more specifically, in terms of the limitation question, he is limited in that he is required to use medications on an ongoing basis. He's on max levels of bronchodilators, of other drugs that are helping to, you know, relieve his asthma symptoms. He uses a respiratory mask at work. He uses an...
Right, and what's the medical testimony that links that to his loss of future earning capacity?
The fact that it exists and is required by his injury, and so if you have somebody who
isn't it really... It's Mr. Carlson's testimony, isn't it? Isn't that fundamentally what we rely on to explain that link, how it's impacted him?
Well,
or is
that,
there something I'm missing?
Sure, no, it's that, and it's Dr. Pacheco's testimony and her notes in her medical records. So, for example, in June of 2016, she wrote a letter to the head of the BN Medical Department, Dr. Gillen, and said, you know, well, I am hopeful, or will I presume that Mr. Carlson's symptoms will resolve. If they do not, he is going to need to change his job duties. She said, at the end of the day, nobody disagrees. There's testimony from Dr. Pacheco. It's in her records. It's in Dr. Yell's records. We've cited a letter from him in our brief as well. It says, look, when you work in a railroad environment and you have asthma, it's just a simple fact that the irritants in your workplace are going to cause exacerbation of symptoms. So if he walked into his workplace tomorrow without medication, without his rescue inhaler, without his respiratory mask that he uses, he could not do his job. So that is a restriction. It's just like a lifting restriction. It's something that's permanent, it's physical, it's ongoing, and the fact of the matter
but
is
the
that...
the fact that he's using an inhaler and a mask, those items aren't what led to his loss of future earning capacity, as I understand your theory, trying to understand his theory.
Right, and I'm sorry if I'm being unclear. Yeah. His use of those items helps to control his symptoms to a level where he can do the physical jobs of being a railroad conductor. However, before he was subject to these restrictions, before he had these symptoms, before he had these sequelae, he was able to work a job that was much more consistent, much more demanding, much more regular, and earn much more money. And that's set out in our brief as well. Once he had these injuries, once he went back to work, even though his symptoms are being controlled, they are not cured, and so he continues to have exacerbation. He continues to have to go to the emergency room from time to time. He continues to have to see his doctors on a regular basis for follow-ups, and he testified that when that happens, it's much easier for him, it's much better for him, he's much more healthy when he's able to work a different job that is not as intensive, that is not as regular, and so he takes a lesser shifts, thus earning less money. And even on those occasions, he still is testifying that he's missing multiple trips per month, which results in, you know, a significant loss of earnings. So at the time of this trial, he was continuing to miss work due to his symptoms. He was continuing to lose wages. And that is something that, based on the evidence, a jury could very definitely infer, particularly given the status of the FELA and the fact that it allows juries to draw much more broad inferences, to presume or infer or conclude, which they did, that he was going to continue to suffer wage loss into the future. And so I think when you break it down and look at it in the context of the cases as well, you know, that's what we see particularly in this Kwapian case, which is a Minnesota case. And so I think with that being even a less favorable standard than the FELA, I think it makes sense to look at that. And that is a case in which the plaintiff suffered some minor injuries, a chin cut, fractured clavicle, when she was in a car accident. So they tried the case. There's a verdict in favor of the plaintiff, and they awarded her $15,000 for loss of future earning capacity. At the trial, there was never any testimony from the plaintiff as to any lines of employment or future areas of desired employment that she was precluded from. She didn't testify that any physician had ever restricted her from any particular physical activity. The symptoms that she described were subjective, which again is not the case here. I mean, we have objective testing continuing to demonstrate that Mr. Carlson has impairments, physical impairments in his lungs, in his vocal cords. But ultimately, the court held that the recovery of future wage or future earning capacity under those symptoms was perfectly acceptable. And they use some language that I think is appropriate to talk about here. And they note that, quote, the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that recovery for future loss of earning capacity was appropriate for a plaintiff who was presently performing homemaker activities and had no plans to resume gainful employment. In that case, and that's the LeMay case, the court said, the impairment of the ability of a woman to work is an injury to her personal rights wholly apart from any pecuniary benefit the exercise of such power may bring. And if her injury has lessened this power, she ought to be able to recover damage. So in that case, again, no expert testimony regarding future employability, no expert testimony or testimony at all regarding her past earnings or anticipated future earnings. And on those facts, Minnesota common law, the claim for loss of future earning capacity goes to the jury. Same in the FELA cases that we've talked about and that I cited earlier. No expert testimony relative to specific jobs or functions that the employees were no longer able to perform or that they were not going to be able to go out and get another job if they tried to. But the simple fact of the matter, it's well within the common knowledge of the average juror that if you are a 40-something-year-old man who has significant lung limitations, you have to use medication, you have to use a respiratory inhaler, you have to use a mask to do your job, and you get fired, you have to go out in the job market and compete with people who don't have any of those limitations. And so that, frankly, in and of itself, is sufficient under the feeling in the cases that we talked about to show that there is...
Did Mr. Carlson testify regarding his ability to go out in the workforce?
He did not...
With those limitations?
He did not specifically say, I can't go into those other occupations, because his intention was to continue working for the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, as he'd done for 12 years.
There right, was I was going to say, I didn't remember that in the... Yeah,
correct,
the evidence
okay,
that I read. I don't know the evidence as well as you do.
Right.
I just wanted to be clear that that wasn't something that was fleshed out at trial with witness testimony.
No, it was not, because
okay.
He was continuing to work.
I understand your point legally. Okay. I'm just trying to understand it factually. That
Very
wasn't
good.
The theory that you presented to the jury.
Very good. And so I think with the few seconds that I have remaining, I would also note that, you know, in the cases that the defendant cites in their brief, the Fashauer case, you know, they talk about that being a good example, but in fact, in that case, the issue went to the jury. And so it kind of proves the point, is that this is a question for the jury on the evidence to make their determination. And so I note that my time is up. I would ask that the district court's order be reversed, and I will yield the podium.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Marianne Ald on behalf of BNSF Railway Company. BNSF respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's judgment. As is evident from Mr. Carlson's opening argument, the sole issue on appeal is whether Mr. Carlson produced any competent evidence to show that his alleged injuries impair his future earning capacity. The district court properly concluded that he did not produce such competent evidence, and therefore the judgment should be affirmed. Well-established case law fully supports the district court's judgment. To start, Mr. Carlson is simply incorrect to suggest that he was necessarily entitled to a jury determination on this question of his capacity to earn in the future. The case law is clear that an FELA plaintiff bears the burden to prove the loss of earning capacity to a reasonable certainty. In his briefing at pages 20 and 21 of the opening brief, Mr. Carlson acknowledges that he bears that burden. So contrary to the suggestion that has been made here, the framework remains the same. Even in an FELA case, the plaintiff has to produce competent evidence to support his claims, and if he does not, the claim does not go to a jury, and entry of judgment as a matter of law is proper.
But counsel, you made that argument that the issue shouldn't go to the jury, and the district court gave it to the jury.
Correct. And so our argument, obviously, is that that shouldn't have been given to the jury, and in hindsight and in review of the record, the district court came to that own conclusion herself. So the fact that it was given to the jury doesn't really change the standard. We've just heard that Fashauer is different because the procedural posture was different. In that case, the jury awarded no damages. Here, the jury did. Doesn't really matter. The standard of review in Fashauer, like here, is the same. The court was required to determine as a matter of law whether any competent evidence supported the verdict. And it held that there was not any competent evidence to support that verdict on loss earning capacity. District court made the same conclusion here ultimately, and so it's really the same.
It's not really quite the same, though, is it, counsel? Because in Fashauer, you have a jury deciding no loss of future earning capacity. So on a JMOL review, this court is going to review that evidence if the jury had gone the other way in this case, in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict.
Understood.
Right. There is a different tilt, and we're going to only examine, for instance, the evidence that favors the plaintiff's theory, which obviously the jury accepted for loss of future earning capacity.
Understood. Okay. My point is that as a matter of law, there is no evidence. And so whether you look at it in the light most favorable or not, there is no competent evidence.
But you've said that a few times. There's no evidence, and we just heard the appellant's counsel arguing that Mr. Carlson testified extensively about his loss of future earning capacity based on his decision to stop taking certain types of shifts. So Would you go to that issue?
I absolutely
will. Because you say no evidence, but we do have Mr. Carlson's evidence for sure. I know you dispute their characterization of the expert evidence.
Certainly. Yeah. And I would point out that in the briefing, and this just to put a fine point in terms of whether or not what Mr. Carlson said was evidence or not, there is a characterization in the briefing of Mr. Carlson at page 23 going over onto 24 that once relegated to working the long haul pull, et cetera, et cetera. There is no evidence of that. Mr. Carlson was not relegated to any such action. Not relegated by BNSF, not relegated by his doctors, not relegated. In fact, he wasn't told to do any such thing by his doctors or anyone else. Instead, in the trial transcript.
We do have, don't we, at least Dr. Yell saying that Mr. Carlson should limit his future exposure.
All right. Let's.
True? I mean, isn't that in the record?
Absolutely. And okay. I want to answer the court's questions. And so let me say first, if you don't mind, what Mr. Carlson has said, and then I'll go back and talk about the testimony of Dr. Pacheco and Dr. Yell, if that's okay. What Mr. Carlson says at page 590 of the trial transcript is that he's not working as much because he used his seniority. This is what he says. I'll read it in the first person. I'm not working as much because I used my seniority to go to the long pool to get a break from the industrial environment that I work in. That is about as good as it gets. He decided to use his seniority to change jobs and do something else, to get a break. There is no one, there is nothing that relegated him to that action. The testimony.
Referring to industrial environment, what he's getting a break from is the condition that caused his health problems.
He made the choice to do that even after he was allowed to go back to work without any restriction. And then this gets me back to your questions about what the doctors said to him, both Pacheco and Yell. In May of 2016, there were letters by both Dr. Pacheco and Dr. Yell dealing with what was going on at the time. He had had, in November of 2015, his first incident. He had had a couple of other claimed incidents that he felt were aggravating his asthma and his vocal cord dysfunction. And so in May, we have letters from Dr. Yell, we have letter from Dr. Pacheco, in which they're saying that he might benefit from a job, that there weren't such irritants in the air while they're figuring out his treatment, essentially. And then after he is given the treatment, he is released to go back to work without any restrictions. And so that's where we are. If you look in the timeline, Dr. Yell's opinion, Dr. Pacheco's opinion from May of 2016 was not open-ended and never-ending.
I don't hear appellant's counsel disagreeing with that. He acknowledged, I think, I heard him acknowledge, and I think it's all over the briefs, that, in fact, Mr. Carlson was returned to work without restrictions. So I think you got that. So here's my more focused question for you. So where's the case law that tells us that to have a loss of future earning capacity claim that Mr. Carlson had to have been returned to work with restrictions? Because I don't see that in the case law.
There's nothing.
What we would need is some sort of evidence for sufficiency purposes to document his loss of future earning capacity based on certainly his testimony, arguably, and do we even need medical expert testimony linking it? So let me know what the case law says.
Many of the cases do have, obviously, medical testimony, and many have also vocational rehabilitation, a vocational expert who has spoken. There are cases that say that vocational expert testimony is not required, and Mr. Carlson did not have that here. There has to be some link, though, between the medicine, the condition, the lost earning capacity that is claimed into the future. And here, there is none. If you go through all of the cases that we have just heard Mr. Carlson's lawyer go through to talk about what the standards are, there was no evidence in this case sufficient to meet those standards, whether you're talking about Kwapian, whether you're talking about Newsom, Russell, Danko, Wiles, Gorniak, all of the cases that Mr. Carlson cited in his brief. Kwapian. The plaintiff had to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that a loss of earning capacity, an impairment in her power to earn a living, was reasonably certain to occur as a result of her injuries. There is no testimony, there is no evidence here of a loss of power, of an impairment in power to earn a living going into the future in Mr. Carlson's case. In Gorniak, court says that the FELA plaintiff may recover for lost earning capacity in the future if he's produced competent evidence suggesting that his injuries have narrowed the range of economic opportunities available to him. There is no evidence from Dr. Pacheco, from Dr. Yale, from Mr. Carlson himself, other than him saying that he chose to do something different.
But counsel, first of all, do you disagree with appellant that the jury has a greater power to infer under a FELA case than they would under the common law, make inferences?
I do agree in general that the FELA certainly is remedial in purpose. I would direct the court's attention to the Sorrell case, which was a 2007 case from the United States Supreme Court, in which that court said the fact that the FELA has a remedial purpose doesn't mean that every interpretation is going to go in favor of the plaintiff. And I would also say that when we hear this pigeon bones broth spun out, and it's a common thing for plaintiffs to say, and I understand why, to say that we get to infer more in this kind of case, but my response to that would be, you still have to have the pigeon bone. You can't have the broth without some bone. And that is the competent evidence that we're looking for in this case and that is lacking. There is no competent evidence in this case that whatever Mr. Carlson's injuries are going to somehow interfere with his earning capacity in the future. Whether we look at it about the horizons for the economy, for the economic opportunities, whether we're looking at it in terms of the power to earn a living, you can take from each one of these cases something slightly different in terms of how the standard is articulated, but it's essentially using the very same standard and applying it to very different evidence in each one of these cases. And in Mr. Carlson's case, the question isn't really the standard. The question is the evidence and how it applies. And there is no evidence, none from his doctor.
If I understand your analysis of the evidence correctly, you're relying on sort of the sequence of events to discredit Dr. Yale and Dr. Pacheco's opinion that Mr. Carlson may need to restrict or change his work environment to accommodating his ongoing permanent injury.
Honestly, Your Honor, I'm not trying to discredit what their opinion was early on. I think
You explained it in terms of the sequence. You know, we have the May 2016 letters, and then we have the subsequent opinions from those same doctors that he could return to work without restrictions. So you're asking us to look at it in that sort of chain of sequence and say there's no opinion after he was returned to work without restrictions, medical opinion, that shows that he had any limitations. Do I get your argument? I'm trying to.
And yes, I think that is a fair assessment, but I would say that from May of 2016 until mm-hmm. the trial, we've gone a year and a half, and Dr. Pacheco is deposed in order to use that testimony at trial, and it is a year and a half later, and she is saying he hasn't had any trouble. He hasn't missed any work.
So here's something
everything is
that I find curious about this. If I do, again, keep correcting me if I'm wrong about how you view the evidence. So this case was submitted to the jury with a very specific line of instructions and a verdict form asking about the loss of future earning capacity. It was stated a little inarticulately as future lost wages, but it was still in there. And there was no objection, was there, by BNSF to either of those things? I know you don't need that objection to pursue the appeal that you're pursuing today, but there wasn't an objection.
There was also no evidence to support it. And so
normally a defendant, when faced with a plaintiff's case where there isn't, as you've been saying over and over, there's no evidence to support a loss of future earning capacity, normally a defendant would stand up then and object to having that line on the verdict form and giving those instructions to the jury.
There had been all kinds of argument during the trial, reading the record in terms of what was supported and what was not, and what Dr. Pacheco's testimony said and did not say. And so going through that process, these things were submitted, And then immediately the decision was made to file the post-verdict motion saying, hey, wait, there's no evidence on this point, and the court legitimately in reviewing what the record was, what the briefing was, concluded that that was correct. And I do think that a fair review of this record, and you, Your Honor, keep saying that we know the record better, I would encourage you to go back to the record and look to see that there was never a time that a doctor said that there was going to be an impairment into the future of the capacity to earn. He didn't testify that he would
best
lose jobs.
Case for saying that that's the evidence that's needed to uphold a jury verdict like this one is what? What's your best case law?
Our best cases are Fashauer and DeChicco. Right. I don't think, though, that there is a difference in the standard
you think
articulated.
We'll find that rule of law in Fashauer and
DeChicco, which is a Second Circuit case.
Right. No, I'm familiar with both. I just couldn't remember which ones you said.
Okay. Yes. And, there are cases that discuss all of them. The Newsom case that goes back and talks about all of the Third Circuit cases.
And just to be clear about my question, it's what I'm looking for is case law that specifically says that it's the medical or expert evidence that's needed to support that future loss of earning capacity.
And I would say, Your Honor, that I'm not taking the position that that's what's needed. I would say that in certain cases, inferences can be drawn elsewhere. It's just that that evidence is not present in the Carlson case. There was nothing that a doctor, there was no testimony from he himself to say, because of my injuries, I'm going to lose money into the future. All he said was is that he's taking a break from that environment, and his doctors are saying that everything is fine and he can go back to work without restriction. So there are no bones, there is no evidence from which, even in an FELA case, we can make those inferences. And so BNSF respectfully requests that the court affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you. Mr. Moreland?
Thank you. Just a few things. I was writing furiously. I hope I can remember everything I wanted to say. I do want to touch back a little bit on the notion of restrictions just really quickly, and I don't mean to be difficult about it, but I think it's not accurate to say that his doctors were saying you can go back and everything is fine. And the notion of restrictions, again, he was restricted. He had to take medicine. He had to use a rescue inhaler. He had to use a mask. I don't see a difference, frankly, between that and a 20-pound lifting restriction. So to suggest that his doctors had given him this full and clear release to full duty with no restrictions, I think is semantically not correct. Like we talked about, and I don't think the BN would disagree with this, if he showed up unmedicated without an albuterol inhaler and without his respiratory mask, he could not do this job. So then we get to the next point, which is, you know, it's been kind of cast as Mr. Carlson just making a decision that he just wanted to work less of his own volition, and that's what he wanted to do, so he did that. And I think the record is clear that Mr. Carlson had worked for 12 long years for the BNSF and had always done his job and had been somebody who worked consistently, wasn't somebody who was looking for breaks, wasn't somebody who was looking to take time off. But I think if we go to the specific note from, and this is what I talked about in opening and counsel mentioned it in her responsive remarks, it's Exhibit 105-072. The entirety of 105 is Dr. Pacheco's medical records from National Jewish. And so this is a letter from Dr. Pacheco to Dr. Laura Gillis, who is the medical director of the BNSF Railway Company.
And the date of the letter?
The date of the letter is June 14, 2016. And so you'll see that Dr. Gillis had asked some questions, and Dr. Pacheco is responding to them. And one of the questions was from Dr. Gillis, please explain what you mean by the above statement, benefit in the future from a job environment that limits exposure to vapors, dust, gases, and fumes. So her question is, what are you referring to when you're talking about a future job environment that limits those exposures? And as we discussed, everyone agrees that the exposures that Mr. Carlson experiences every day in his workplace are those that exacerbate the symptoms of his RADS, that being cold air, wind, diesel fumes, alkali materials, you know, acidic type vapors, all those kind of things are exacerbating of RADS and vocal cord dysfunction. And so she says in response, quote, whereas I do anticipate that Mr. Carlson's symptoms will resolve, the only way to determine this is the case I'm sorry, the only way to determine if this is the case is for him to return to work. If his symptoms do not resolve, then the patient may need a change in his work environment. He returned to work. His symptoms were fairly well managed to the point that he could do the physical job of being a conductor, but they were exacerbated and they were, aggravated by the diesel fumes, by the other fumes, to the point that he just couldn't do it as frequently. And so it's not that he just decided he was going to work less of his own volition. And the testimony bore that out when you read through the rest of it that said he's getting a break from the industrial environment. And so his doctor has said, if you are not feeling well in your industrial environment, you need to change your job so that you have less of those exposures, which he did. So there is a link, I think, very definitely between what Dr. Pacheco said in terms of what her opinions were and what Mr. Carlson did in having to reduce his working volume and suffering a corresponding loss. Again, if we go back, I don't think the case law supports the argument, and I think counsel just acknowledged that, in fact, medical testimony is not per se required. But I think in this case, given that it's a FELA case, given that the jury was instructed on the issue with no objection from defendant and heard all the evidence and reached a verdict and awarded him those damages, I frankly don't see any basis to overturn that, and I think it has to be reinstated. I think it's a very clear line, and the evidentiary basis is solid. Now, with a couple comments with respect to Fashauer and DeChico, which are the two main cases that they relied on. Fashauer we discussed. It helps us. It helps the plaintiff. That case was submitted to the jury. They found no economic loss for future, or they found no future loss of earning capacity, and the Third Circuit said, on that evidence, fine. But the point is, who gets to make the decision? And in Fashauer, it was the jury. DeChico is a Second Circuit case from 1985, and in that case, the plaintiff had a bunch of safeguards in place that he was very clearly not going to suffer any economic future losses, because even if he got booted out of the current job he had enough seniority to exercise and go into another job with a railroad that would pay him the same or more. Mr. Carlson has no protection like that. He's a conductor. And DeChico also has been, the Second Circuit has criticized it, and no FELA cases follow it. And that's discussed in our brief. And again, I'm out of time, so I think the verdict should be reinstated, and we respectfully ask that that be done. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, the matter is submitted, and we'll have our decision out within the 90 days. And safe travels.
Thank you.